Today is Thursday, July 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump threatens he may cut off funding if U.S. schools don't open in the fall.
The president does not have the authority to open schools.
The U.S. Supreme Court rules in favor of the Trump administration on two cases impacting thousands of women.
This opens the door for private employers, both religious and secular employers, to deny women contraceptive coverage.
Also ahead, the family of the late Bob Marley reimagining one of his biggest hits. It's all on today's International Edition. Global coronavirus cases exceeded 12 million Wednesday as evidence mounts of the airborne spread of the disease that has killed more than 500,000 people in 7 months. The U.S. continues to have the largest number of cases as the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Wednesday reported an increase of more than 50,000 new cases. At a news conference Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany was asked about a report from Tulsa, Oklahoma health officials saying President Trump's rally in late June likely contributed to a dramatic surge in new coronavirus cases there.
I have no data to indicate that on my end, but it's the decision of individuals whether to go. We encourage the wearing of masks. As the president said, if he couldn't distance, he would, but it's the individual choice of the person.
Meanwhile, President Trump is threatening to withhold federal money if schools don't reopen in the fall. He says the guidelines his own federal health officials have created for schools to reopen are, quote, impractical and expensive. Soon after Trump's comments, Vice President Mike Pence reiterated the administration's position.
This is not just simply about making sure our kids are learning and they're advancing academically, but for their mental health, for their well-being, for their physical health, for nutrition. We got to get our kids back to school.
Pence said that Centers for Disease Control will release additional school guidance next week.
We're going to be looking for ways to give states a strong incentive.
But New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, whose state was the first epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic in the U.S., said no one needs incentive to reopen schools.
We will open the schools if it is safe to open the schools. Everybody wants the schools open. Everybody.
He and other governors pushed back, saying the president does not have the authority on what schools do.
It's not up to the president of the United States. There is something called the Constitution that guides government power. And then there are a series of laws that are based on that constitution. And the president does not have the authority to open schools.
President Trump has accused Democrats of wanting to keep schools closed for election year reasons rather than health concerns. Harvard and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology have filed a federal lawsuit Wednesday seeking to block the Trump administration from barring international students from staying in the U.S. if they take classes entirely online this fall. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The universities say the directive violates the Administrative Procedures Act because officials failed to offer a reasonable basis justifying the policy and because the public was not given notice to comment. ICE notified colleges Monday that international students will be forced to leave the U.S. or transfer to another college if their schools operate entirely online this fall. New visas will not be issued to students at those schools, and others at universities offering a mix of online and in-person classes will be barred from taking all of their classes online. Harvard President Lawrence Bacow says the order's cruelty is surpassed only by its recklessness. I'm Julie Walker.
American colleges and universities who were blindsided by the Trump administration order on foreign students were already grappling with adjustments to the fall semester and logistical challenges of safely reopening classes, and they're now scrambling to assist the thousands of foreign students who might be impacted. Joining us now is Johan Chen, a Chinese national who's been studying government and international politics at George Mason University in Virginia. Thanks for being with us. So you are here in the U.S. on a student F-1 visa. What was your first reaction after hearing the announcement?
Naturally, I was really stressed because my entire schedule was changing to online for next semester. So I didn't know what to do. But then I realized GMU was going to operate hybrid, so I could just make some minor changes to my schedule and I'll be better.
Were you ever worried that you would actually have to leave?
Yeah, because in the statement, they were really firm about it. They said you're legal status will be, you know, might be affected, and then you can either you will probably be deported, or you have to transfer school. It just sounded really serious, so I was worried that I might have to leave.
Did you already start thinking of what you would do? Would you transfer to a different school? Would you try to stay in the country, or would you just go back home to try to go to school there?
I am trying my best to stay here in the United States, and just trying to stay. I'm not considering transferring or going back. I was just editing my schedule so that it follows the guideline.
In general, what do you think about this new policy that the Trump administration has just put forward?
In my opinion, obviously Trump wants schools to open. He wants schools to open in fall. So I think this new policy is like a statement to the schools around the country to tell them that if you don't open, then you're going to lose your international students. And of course, us international students get affected by this policy. Regarding the international student community, they're also stressed and shocked.
Well, how do you think this will impact others like yourself at universities that are only offering online due to very high levels of the pandemic?
I don't think it's a positive. Obviously, they have to go home now. And when they go home, they can't really take online classes as well, because especially for Chinese people, the internet has restrictions. And then there's also, the time zone difference, like a 12-hour time zone difference. It's going to completely mess up their schedule to be able to attend online classes. So many people, I believe, when they leave the country, they'll just take a gap year.
What made you decide to come to the U.S. to study?
Most of my middle school and my entirety of my high school education, I went to an Ivy school for that, an international school. I was just a little bit westernized in terms of the studying side of me is pretty westernized. So I'm more used to the way that how Westerners teach and study. And I really think America is a great opportunity for me to expand my horizon, since, it's a really big country and has a really, in my opinion, a really good educational system. So many universities and such, all the advantages. So I decided to come to the United States.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. Glad that you're not going to have to be packing up. That would have been a difficult situation.
GM, you said you're trying to figure something out for the international students. I think the school is at least trying to support us, and I'm very glad.
George Mason University student Johan Chen, thanks so much. Africa now has more than 500,000 confirmed coronavirus cases. AP correspondent Charles Deledesma reports.
The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announces the grim milestone after another day of more than 10,000 confirmed cases, a new global hotspot. The true number of cases among the continent's 1.3 billion people is unknown, as its 54 countries continue to face a serious shortage of testing materials. So far, most testing has been concentrated in capital cities, but infections in many cases have spread beyond them. Africa's coronavirus crisis comes as a growing number of its countries are deciding to reopen their skies to commercial flights, saying their economies are sick too. I'm Charles Deledesma.
The United States Supreme Court ruled Wednesday in favor of the religious rights of employers in two cases that would leave more than 70,000 women without free contraception and tens of thousands of people with no way to sue for job discrimination. In both cases, the court ruled 7-2 with liberal and conservative justices ruling in favor of the Trump administration and religious employers. Joining us now to understand more about this, what this all means, is attorney Joel Paul, professor at UC Hastings Law School. Let's start with the more prominent of the two cases that the court ruled on Wednesday, which involved changes sought by the Trump administration to President Barack Obama's health care law. What specifically was this about?
The court ruled in a case brought by the Little Sisters of the Poor. The court upheld the Trump administration's regulations that allowed both a religious and non-religious organizations, even for-profit corporations, to exempt themselves from the Obamacare requirement that they provide coverage for contraception if it offends their religious or moral beliefs. So in effect, this opens the door for private employers, both religious and secular employers, to deny women contraceptive coverage under the Obamacare Act. Basically, the court upheld the Trump administration's regulations that allowed both religious and private corporations to exempt themselves from the Obamacare requirement that they provide contraceptive coverage to their employees.
What was the opinion as to why they made that determination? They ruled that way.
Well, the court majority said that the statute itself, the Women's Health Amendment to the Obamacare Act, was sufficiently broad that it gave the Health and Human Services Department discretion to decide whether to exempt certain employers. Majority also suggested that there might be a religious exemption under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which might have meant that even if the Trump administration had not adopted these regulations, that private corporations could claim that they don't have to provide contraceptive coverage for women employees.
The second case, while not quite as high profile, will still impact many women, but also minorities. Is that correct?
In the second case, Our Lady of Guadalupe School, the court held that teachers at parochial schools are not protected against employment discrimination. And this case represents a significant expansion of the so-called ministerial exemption under the First Amendment's religion clauses. It raises the prospect that almost any employee of a religious organization may lose their right to sue if they're discriminated against based on their age, on their sex, their race, ethnicity, or disability. So it impacts not only women, but also other minorities as well.
It was interesting that several of the liberal justices sided with the conservative majority and the Trump administration.
Justices Kagan and Justice Breyer have often been closer to the conservatives on questions involving religious practices. They tend to be more protective of the freedom of religion, even when it may undermine or limit the rights of minorities. You know, one of the things about this case is that it leaves the door open, for example, for religious organizations to discriminate against, for instance, LGBT groups. And that, I think, seems like the next logical step in the expansion of this sphere of protection for religious employers.
Joel Paul, professor at the UC Hastings Law School in San Francisco. Thanks for being with us. President Trump and Mexican President Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador met for the first time Wednesday at the White House, despite criticism from some U.S. Democrats and Mexicans who widely dislike Trump due to his immigration policies. In a news conference alongside his Mexican counterpart, Trump touted a good relationship.
The relationship between the United States and Mexico has never been closer than it is right now. And as the president said a little while ago, people were betting against that.
The two leaders are reported to have briefly discussed immigration. Human Rights Watch says the bodies of 180 men have been dumped and buried in recent months in the Burkina Faso town of Djibo in the northern Soum region. In a report issued Wednesday, the group accused security forces of executing the men after detaining them on suspicion of supporting armed Islamist groups. For the past few years, hundreds have been killed in fighting between Islamist militants and government forces, with both sides accused of targeting civilians. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Human Rights Watch West Africa Director Corinne Dufka, beginning with Burkina Faso's defense minister telling Reuters the killings could have been committed by jihadist groups using stolen army uniforms and logistical equipment.
We spoke with over 20 witnesses, residents of Djibo, who described the appearance of bodies on the streets of Djibo that began around November 2019 and has continued until June. Now, they described the appearance of these bodies, where they were found, and then where they were buried, including in a number of mass burials, which took place in March and April. So nearly all of those I interviewed believed that the vast majority, if not all of the bodies, were former detainees, people who'd been detained by the security forces in the context of investigations into the presence of jihadists or counterterrorism operations. A good number of the residents identified among the dead a number of people, including some of their family members. Furthermore, a good number of residents described hearing shots in the middle of the night and then hearing the sound of heavy vehicles moving back and forth, and then in the morning finding these groups of bodies all over Jibo.
Why would the security forces, you know, if they are doing this, as you're alleging based on these interviews, why would they be doing this? What's the context for this?
Jibo is in the Soum region of Burkina Faso, which is the epicenter of activity of the armed Islamists, who since 2016 have been active and have been attacking both military and civilian targets. Now, there is a very worrying ethnic dynamic which underscores this conflict in Burkina Faso, indeed throughout the Sahel, and that is that the jihadists have concentrated their recruitment on the Fulani or Pol, who are largely herders, and the vast majority of the dead were, according to the witnesses, members of the Pol ethnic group, which is to say those that are collectively blamed and collectively identified by the authorities as supporting the jihadists, which was another reason why the residents believed that it was the security forces who were involved in these killings.
What evidence do you have that these people were killed by security forces?
So none of our witnesses actually saw the killings, which appeared to have taken place at night, and Jibo is under curfew. But there are a number of dynamics which suggest to us, and which certainly suggest to our witnesses, that it's the security forces that are engaged in a good number of these killings, if not the majority. First, that a number of them had family members who they witnessed being apprehended or arrested by the security forces. And when they identified one of their family members, that individual was always found with up to 17 or 18 other people. Furthermore, they said that while the jihadists are around the Jibo area, the town is squarely controlled by the security forces. Many of them said that they didn't believe that the jihadists could be driving around in the middle of a town controlled by the army under a curfew. Furthermore, a good number of them were found with their hands and their eyes bound, and the majority seemed to have been shot, and some of them actually found bullet casings as well.
Has Human Rights Watch been able to actually visit the town of Jibo and investigate on the ground in person, or have there been any photographs or anything like this of the bodies, of the graves?
The research was done both the last time I was in Ouagadougou and then by telephone with our network of people who are those representing lots of different sectors and in various different ethnic groups. Now, I asked as well about the photos, and people were absolutely terrified, first of all, to even talk about these killings, to talk about the mass burials which took place in March and April, and they were afraid to take pictures. In fact, I had a number of people telling me that during this organized mass burial which took place, they were expressly told not to carry smartphones, not to take pictures. That said, I received a number of maps and drawings of where bodies were found and where they were buried, and we are currently analyzing satellite photos as well. But the graves are difficult to see because, of course, they're mounds of earth that are covered by sand and, you know, and a few branches. It would require on-the-ground investigation.
Landmines left behind in Tripoli battle zones have left 138 people dead since the end of May. According to the UN, they were mostly civilians. Now, as international forces intensify their fighting in Libya, locals say between the landmines, battles, and rising coronavirus cases, the city has become much more dangerous than ever before. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul.
In a video shared widely in early June, a man sits on the ground with blood on his face and one leg splayed lifeless to the side. "Where am I?" he asks in Libyan Arabic. The man holding the camera tells him he's on the airport road in Tripoli. His car hit an IED, improvised explosive device, and his companion was killed. On Sunday, another blast killed two humanitarian workers who were going house to house to remove explosive devices from civilian areas that not long ago were battle zones. This is 22-year-old Ahmed bin Mahmoud. His childhood friend, Tariq, was one of the victims. Witnesses told him Tariq and his colleagues were looking for bombs in the home of an elderly man. They found one and deactivated it, but another was hidden below, and two of the three men were killed when it exploded. 81 of the 138 victims were civilians, and many others were cleaning mines when they died. In February, the United Nations Mining Agency warned that Libya is awash with explosives, which pose a grave threat to civilians. This is Bob Seddon of the UN Mine Action Service in Libya.
Libya has the world's largest uncontrolled ammunition stockpile. It is estimated that there are between 150,000 and 200,000 tons of uncontrolled munitions across Libya.
The UN support mission in Libya says the bombs were planted by Libya's eastern forces, the Libyan National Army, which is loyal to strongman and de facto eastern leader Khalifa Haftar. Haftar's forces have been fighting those loyal to the Western government, the UN-recognized government of national accord, for more than a year since Haftar announced his intention to take Tripoli, the Western capital, by force. In early June, Haftar's forces withdrew from Tripoli, but both sides have since been supplied with massive amounts of weapons and air and ground support from other countries vying for power in Africa's most oil-rich country. Observers warn that while the fighting has been minimal recently, the stage is set for a protracted proxy war between powerful rivals like Turkey and Russia. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
U.S. President Donald Trump says he is open to another summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But despite the recent comments by the U.S. president, North Korea has been signaling it's uninterested in resuming stalled nuclear talks. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
Twice in the past week, North Korea has said it has no interest in resuming nuclear talks with the United States. But that didn't stop U.S. President Donald Trump from saying Tuesday he believes North Korea does want another summit. In an interview with Gray Television, Trump said he would certainly meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un for a fourth time. Such a meeting, he said, could be profitable. Trump and Kim have already met three times, but the summits have produced few tangible results. North Korea has boycotted the talks for months. It's upset the U.S. won't relax sanctions or provide security guarantees in exchange for limited steps to dismantle its nuclear program. Last week, a senior North Korean diplomat said more talks would only benefit Trump. On Tuesday, North Korea's foreign ministry said its stance on the issue is as clear as day. Speaking Tuesday in Seoul, Steve Biegun, the top U.S. negotiator on North Korea, downplayed those remarks. He also said he does not take guidance from North Korean foreign ministry officials.
I take my guidance from the conclusions of the several meetings that President Trump and Chairman Kim have had over the last 2 years. Their vision is what guides our team.
Earlier this month, South Korean President Moon Jae-in said he would like to see Trump and Kim hold another meeting before the U.S. presidential election in November. Some analysts have questioned whether Trump has other priorities. With just 4 months to go until the election, Trump is badly trailing Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, in the polls. North Korea is not seen as a major issue in the U.S. election. But if Trump could revive the North Korea talks, it could help highlight what White House officials had once heralded as a signature Trump foreign policy achievement. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. The U.S. Supreme Court is due today to rule on President Donald Trump's bid to block his financial records from being obtained by Democratic-led House of Representatives committees and a New York prosecutor. They include three cases focused on Trump's efforts to block subpoenas issued to third parties, not the president himself, to hand over his financial records, which he has fought hard to keep secret. More than 150 world-renowned academics, writers, and artists have signed a letter that was published this week expressing support for global anti-racism protests while lamenting on an intolerant climate that has set in on all sides. American linguist and activist Noam Chomsky, veteran women's rights campaigner Gloria Steinem, author J.K. Rowling, and journalist Fareed Zakaria were among the signatories. You're listening to International Edition. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
that AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Millions of people flock to San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge each year for the stunning visuals. Now, a glitch in a safety upgrade is providing extraordinary sound effects as well. Matt Dibble listens in.
You might think the Golden Gate Bridge, which has stood at the mouth of San Francisco Bay for nearly a century, has nothing new to reveal beyond its stunning beauty. But recently, the 83-year-old icon has become a social media sensation.
Oh, dude. Nice encounters in the third.
The bridge has begun to sing. San Francisco resident Anna Clafter can hear it from her house about 5 miles away.
And I watched the video and I was like, what a crazy sound. And then after it ended, I like heard the sound in the background. It's quite loud, actually. Since then, I've been hearing it almost every afternoon or evening.
What is the source of this strange sound? It can be traced to a new safety upgrade to the bridge. According to the Golden Gate Public Affairs Manager, Paolo Kosolich-Swartz.
We've been replacing handrail on the west sidewalk with new railing that has thin vertical slats that are designed to allow more air to flow through them. One effect of that is that the bridge, now at very high winds and with specific angles, sings or hums. We knew going into the replacement that the bridge would sing during high wind events, but what we didn't know was just how loud that might be. Some people love it and find it soothing and meditative. Others have found it somewhat unpleasant.
Electronic musician Mr. Bill was inspired to collaborate with the bridge.
So I rode my bike like right into the middle of the bridge, and then I just took a field recorder with me and recorded it and then turned it into music. I was just working on a few tracks at the time, and that one just happened to be slightly closer to being in the key of the bridge.
Engineers are looking into the possibility of dampening the sound. But until then, when the wind is right, it's showtime.
Bob Marley's children and chart-topping grandson have reimagined one of his biggest hits to assist children affected by the coronavirus pandemic. Stephen Marley, Adela Marley, and Skip Marley have joined forces to produce a new version of One Love, which will be released July 17th and includes special guest appearances from other musicians. Bob Marley and the Wailers released One Love in 1977. All proceeds from the new version of the song will support Reimagine, UNICEF's global campaign for coronavirus relief efforts focused on helping and aiding children around the world. Bob Marley died of cancer in 1981 at the age of 36. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you for listening. Yeah.